I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Something cute, okay?
You always do what Jennifer tells you to do.
It's just that I like the same things that she likes.
Hey, Jennifer. You look really pretty.
Why don't you just come by my place? Well, this is random.
This isn't really your house, is it?
We can play mommy and daddy.
No way.
Welcome to Rewatchability. It's the podcast where we rewatch old movies and see how they hold up in the modern eye. I'm Robert Larone. With me, as always, is...
Blaine Waters.
And...
J.M. McNabb.
And today we have two very special guests. I'll let them introduce themselves.
Hi, my name is Alex Nursel. I'm from the podcast Parkdale Haunt.
Hey, I'm Emily Kellogg, and I am also from the podcast Parkdale Haunt.
Thanks for joining us here. Why don't you tell everybody a little bit about your podcast, since that's the reason you're on here, to share with all of our listeners what you're doing.
Emily, you want to go for that? Because I always give the worst answers.
Now I want to hear your answer, though, Alex.
Let Emily go first, and then I will give like my terrible answer.
I feel like you're jinxing me, Alex. But our podcast, Parkdale Haunt, it's a serialized fiction horror podcast. So what that means is we're telling one long scary story over 10 episodes.
Nice.
And the story's about two best friends, me and Alex, but you know, our fictional characters, so Claire and Judith. In the story, Claire inherits a house in the Toronto neighborhood of Parkdale from a family that she never knew. They go there to check things out. It's a little weird. They think they're just going to be doing a fun renovation, but they uncover Latin scribblings on the walls, and there are weird sounds coming from the frigid basement. And as they start to investigate the mystery of the house, Claire seems to be losing her mind more and more and more, until ultimately she goes missing. And Judith is doing anything she can to find her best friend.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That sounds thrilling.
Yeah.
Also, I know that Parkdale is a scary place, you know, for a lot of us who have spent time there.
I love Parkdale. I lived in Parkdale for 5 years, I think, and I wanted to set it there because I love all those old houses that all look haunted. It's beautiful.
That are all like $5 million now.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
I mean...
Yeah.
You can get a haunted one for about $4 million.
Oh, well, nice. That's good. Yeah, I felt
it's
like
worth it.
The most fictional part of your story was like getting a house at all.
Yeah, honestly, like that part is just wish fulfillment.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, she's fully getting it through chance. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just pop up and I'm like, it's a podcast about several people making a series of bad decisions. Enjoy.
That's been our podcast for... 9 years now. So.
It's a formula that works. And we should mention that we are on the Entertainment One Podcast Network, and we should also thank our Patreons. Those are the folks who give us a little bit of money every month, and that helps us keep the podcast running. And in return, you get the podcast early and ad-free, and sometimes you get that sweet, sweet bonus content that nobody else gets, the exclusive stuff. Like, for example, like... Recently, Weekend at Bernie's came up in the news because there was speculation that, you know, somebody might be weekending at Bernie's, the president. Well, we did an episode on Weekend at Bernie's, but only for Patreon. So if you want to hear us talk about Weekend at Bernie's, you have to become a Patreon at patreon.com/rewatchability.
It's the only way to know what's happening with Trump is to listen,
that's right,
to listen to a podcast on Weekend at Bernie's. It's great.
So I think this is a rare movie. I don't think most of us have seen this before. Emily, you're the one who sort of brought this movie to us. What is the movie and why did you bring it to us?
So the movie is Jennifer's Body, and it came out in 2009. It is starring Megan Fox and Amanda Seyfried. And it is written by the writer of Juno, Diablo Cody. Mm-hmm. Cody. And its reception in 2009 was pretty lukewarm. It came out at the same time, same year at least, as the Transformer movies. So we were really going through a we hate Megan Fox kind of phase.
Right. Yeah.
And there was a lot of sort of controversy about, well, I suppose not at the time, but now that we're kind of looking at the movie again, there's been a lot of talk about just the way that the film was marketed, because it's a movie that is kind of for teenage girls. Like, it's about girls, for girls, but it was marketed as sort of like a male fantasy fulfillment thing. So it's a movie that people have kind of come back to after the whole Me Too movement and are kind of reassessing as kind of a feminist cult movie.
Right. Yeah, there's definitely been a lot of that in the zeitgeist of talking about this movie and reexamining it. Well, why don't you tell us the first time that you saw Jennifer's Body?
So actually, I only saw it a few years ago. I remember very specifically not wanting to see it in 2009. Because of the marketing. And so,
had you seen Juno?
I had, yeah.
So did you like Juno?
Yeah, I loved Juno.
Okay, but it was just the marketing that threw you off of this. You're like, I liked that movie, but this movie seems like Diablo Cody's taking a turn or something.
I didn't even realize it was the same writer.
Oh, okay.
I just saw horror movie with sexy lady, sexy cheerleader.
Right, sure.
Oh, I've seen a million of those. Like, I don't need to see another slasher along those lines.
Yeah.
So I was doing a project a couple years ago where I decided that I wanted to watch 99 horror movies in a year.
Nice.
I've watched a lot of horror movies in the past, but there were just kind of some gaps in my knowledge. So I was like, okay, this is a way to challenge myself to actually see like every horror movie. And I've discovered some gems along the way. But this was one that really stuck out to me. And it was just before sort of all of this media has come out about the reevaluation of it. So we know that now people are kind of looking at it as a almost response to Me Too, because Megan Fox's character Jessica is sacrificed by a kind of mediocre indie band so that they can gain
very
success.
Mediocre.
Yeah, the eyeliner says that all.
For sure. So people are looking at it as like sort of a revenge film against men sacrificing women to further their careers. So I think it's kind of interesting to look at now.
So is that something that you got an impression of when you first viewed the movie before all of these articles came out?
I think the thing that I got when I first watched it is I was like, okay, sure, I guess you could call this feminist in that Jessica is murdering men. Like, you know.
That's, I believe, first wave feminism.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, there aren't all that many horror movies that are female dominated in that way. Like, I'm trying to think of others that are about female friendships. And so thinking about like The Craft or Heathers. Then the other one I thought of was Martyrs, which is like a French extremist film and very different from this. And about torture.
Yeah.
But anyway.
That's totally different than female friendship.
Oh, yeah.
No, but it's also about female friendship.
Oh, okay. Well, also, one of the other ones that you mentioned was Ginger Snaps, which is a Canadian film. But that's also about female friendship and also has a lot of similarities, I think, apparently, to Juno. Or not Juno, to Jennifer's Body.
Michael Cera's in that as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I guess when Alex and I rewatched the movie this weekend, the thing that I kind of got is that instead of being like sort of feminist because Jessica's killing men, I found it to be more interesting because it's an exploration of like the friendship between Needy and Jessica. And I actually think that that is the most feminist part of the movie.
For sure.
Definitely.
Yeah. Okay. So.
Yeah. I felt like that was the backbone of the whole movie was their friendship.
Yeah, absolutely. What about you, Alex? So you didn't see this when it first came out, but what were your impressions of it? Were you like aware of Diablo Cody's work? Did you sort of have any interest in her work as a screenwriter or anything like that?
Yeah, I didn't see the movie when it first came out, I think just because I wasn't really into horror movies at the time. And also, again, the marketing was very, as Emily had mentioned, like very focused on like, hey, guys, do you want to see Megan Fox make out with a woman? And and like, I'm into it, but I don't want to be pandered to. And so I didn't see it. So I saw it for the first time. And it's really funny because I really enjoyed it. I did not find it scary at all, but I really enjoyed it. I think because it felt incredibly, like, weirdly realistic high school in a way that, like, I feel like a lot of movies fail to kind of do. Not in the way that it wasn't like people talk, like no one talks like that and no one acts like that and no one looks this good. Like Amanda Seyfried looks amazing and they're just like, put some glasses on her.
Right.
She's a big nerd. But
Hair and a ponytail.
But there's a level of camaraderie and toxicity and stuff that I was like, this feels super real and for high school. But it's funny because afterwards I went and I looked up some reviews from the time. From like 2009, from when it came out, and wow, these reviews are really awful to read now. One of them just talked about, and this stuck in my head about how the movie was bad because Megan Fox, they were like, you could see all the little hairs in her back, so obviously, like, the cinematographer hates her because it's gross. And I was like, what? Like, just like the fine sort of like natural downy hair that like anyone would have on their skin. And I was like, and they were just like, and I just keep thinking about this person writing this review being like, yeah, what a nasty, gross thing to see. I was like, what?
What a nasty, gross review.
Was the review written by Michael Bay?
I'm in a bad movie club and we have decided we're going to citizens arrest Michael Bay. Because
of the you're doing a patriotic duty.
I know. We watched Armageddon. That was truly a mistake.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great movie. Jennifer's Body is a really interesting movie, and I think I like that it's having a little bit of a renaissance now.
Cool.
I love that reviewer, like, this is a movie where she actually like pukes up like what looks like oil all over the place, and like the disgusting part is like her hair. Like, that's the disgusting part of the film. Okay.
We shouldn't be reminded that women have, you know, flaws or, you know, hair, right?
Any body hair, not allowed.
It doesn't make us comfortable, and I don't feel titillated. So, guys, what about us? I mean, Blaine, this movie was marketed towards men. You didn't see this. Why not? You love screenwriters. We've talked about some of Diablo Cody's other movies, and I know that you like them. So what's the deal, man?
I did like Diablo Cody. I like looked her up after Juno. I was really into Juno. I watched Juno a lot. Loved her dialogue, obviously. That was a big point of hers. And then this one came out, and I was like, oh, like from the marketing, it looks like they took an idea from Diablo Cody, put 7 other writers on it, and made it horrible. Because what you saw in the marketing was just like 2 girls making out, or like, I don't know, her back hair. I don't know. And you just saw like bodies, and so it felt like, I was like, well, this is kind of, I don't know. And Hollywood at the time was so big into her being an ex stripper too, which I was like, she's a great writer, and everyone's being like, but she used to be a stripper. So that stuff kind of set me off course, and it looked like any other movie, and I feel like maybe I was thinking I was too old for it. Like, I was like, oh, I want to watch film, you know, not just this schlock over here.
Joke's on you. You watched it when you were 10 years older.
Yeah. Well, now I feel like I film is a lot of different things, and it's not just the one thing that I thought it was back then. So I've been humbled. I've been wanting to watch this movie for a while, and it was one of my wife's on her list to watch. I think she found it on a list of movies that weren't scary, but still horror movies. Those are needed too. And I feel like this movie kind of really hits a spot in cinema where there's not a lot of it there. So I'm excited to talk about it. What about you, JM?
I saw it because I like the marketing.
Yeah.
I saw it in the Maxim magazine. I
did see it like before. It was probably maybe a few years after it came out, because I had the same kind of knee-jerk reaction to the, you know, the way it was sold. It didn't seem sort of up my alley. But I think it was the Diablo Cody of it all. Once I didn't love Juno, but maybe it was when Young Adult came out, because I really liked that movie.
Yeah,
so,
mm-hmm. Yeah, me too.
I think I went back and rented it then, and I quite liked it. Like, even, you know, before we get into kind of the deeper meanings of it and sort of the, like you said, the sort of more feminist aspects or the LGBTQ readings of it. I think it's just like a really effective little horror story. Like, I don't mm-hmm. even really understand why it was so attacked by critics at the time. Like, it's a funny, you know, it just works well. And I actually rewatched it earlier this year for like a piece I was writing about, like, movies that have sort of a deeper meaning that have been culturally dismissed over the years. And yeah, I thought it was great. I really like this movie, and I'm glad that it's being embraced in the way that it is now. Like, even Karen Kusama is directing like the new Dracula movie.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
So clearly, like, people have come around to the fact that that this was a good movie, that this is a great horror story, and I'm really glad we're going to talk about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, I didn't see this one when it came out. I had seen Juno. I really loved Juno. I was sort of excited to see what Diablo Cody did next. But I think that the reputation of this movie just sort of swooped in before I had a chance to even consider seeing it. And it was just sort of, you know, seen as like a bad movie. And I don't know if it was so much the marketing for me, but it just... it didn't seem like it was going to be a successful endeavor. So I just sort of missed it for that reason. And, you know, I have seen, I think there's one Diablo Cody movie I haven't seen, the one that she directed. But she's definitely like one of my favorite screenwriters. So I was really excited to sort of take a look at this. And yeah, like, a big part of that has been the people who have been sort of critically reevaluating it. So... That's I guess the story. I mean, I think everybody just needs to sort of like take a look at this movie and see it for themselves, because nobody was apparently in the right place to actually give it any sort of thought when it came out.
Yeah. And even the reviewers were just reviewing the people in it and not the movie itself, it sounds like. Yeah. So.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. We'll definitely get to some of that. But we should first go through the movie bit by bit. So it starts with Amanda Seyfried. She is playing this character named Needy Leswicki, and she is in some sort of mental institution when the movie opens up. And like, she seems like she is like a crazy girl. Like, everything about the way that she's sort of introduced, like, yeah, she's in the mental institution, and then we find out that she is a kicker. At one point, a orderly asks her about her dietary choices, and she kicks this woman in the face and like sends her like flying over, and then like all these other orderlies have to like get her in control. So, I mean, the impression that we've got at this point about this person is that she is not very stable, and you know, it's kind of scary.
Also, that orderly was like a Terminator, because she just looked back up and there was like no blood on her face. She was just like, she kicked me in the face, how dare she. Like, oh my god, she's invincible.
But she is going to tell us the sort of story of how she got there, and it does involve her friend Jennifer. And there's some differences between Needy and Jennifer. Like, Jennifer is very, very, very attractive, and Needy is wearing glasses. So
that's the one thing is that in the start when they first show Amanda Seyfried, I'm like, she looks amazing. And then they're like, here's Needy. She's the awkward one. I'm like, is she though? She just has like her hair pulled back in kind of a not even unflattering, just kind of a lazy way.
Yeah. Yeah. But they do make like a big deal about their friendship and about how their friendship has persisted, you know, despite this difference between them, because, you know, sandbox love never dies and they are like good friends, she says. But even like before anything like, you know, supernatural happens.
Wasn't that the sequel to Phantom of the Opera? Sandbox Love Never Dies.
Oh no, I'm gonna leave. Got reminded of Love Never Dies.
Just gonna go.
Mic drop.
But I mean, it doesn't seem like their friendship is all that good. First of all, like, Needy will drop everything to sort of attend to Jennifer's wishes. Jennifer seems to like insult her friend all the time and just like say really mean things to her, and they seem to have like a really complicated relationship from the get-go.
Guess he's got the whip until 11:30. A 2003 Chrysler Sebring, and it's all mine. Oh, hi, Chip. It smells like Thai food in here. Have you guys been fucking?
Oh, you're gross.
You're gross. You're gross.
So gross.
You're fucking gross. Let's go to the club.
Holiday Lane is not a club. It's a bar. In fact, it's not even a bar. It's like a bingo hall with taps.
Eat my ass, Chip. You're just jello because you're not invited.
Yeah, I feel like the high school is really putting a strain on both of them because, like, one's cool and one's not. How could they hang out? Whereas hopefully high school is different
now. It's a very early 2000s setup.
Yeah.
I don't know what this says about me, like, as a person and my past, but I guess I graduated high school in 2008, and I found their friendship to be very relatable to friendships that I had in high school.
Yeah. Oh, no. Well, I mean... That might not be a good thing.
It's okay. I'm in therapy now. It's fine.
Okay. Well, okay. Great. As long as you're working through it.
Cool.
Podcasts are the best place to work through.
Yeah, no.
That's what they're for.
We wrote an entire podcast.
Thanks for being here, guys.
And listen to Parkdale Haunt if you want to hear more of Emily's trauma.
I mean, really, though. Anyway, I love the sort of power dynamic, and especially the way that sort of Jennifer like pulls her out to that concert in that bar, only to kind of ignore her as her wing person. I was like, oh god, I have been that girl, just like standing there watching my friend go after this guy who sucks, and there's just like nothing I can do about it. And I'm just like, why is this my life?
Yeah, yeah. Well, yes,
We've all had friends like that, for sure.
They do go to this concert. This is the next big set piece. And they want to go see this band called Low Shoulder. In fact, it's really Jennifer that wants to go see him because the lead singer is spicy. I have to take some
salty.
But... Oh,
he knows it.
Okay.
He knows it, too.
Yeah, it was salty, not spicy, right? You're getting your flavors mixed up.
He was umami. And that was...
well, also, like, maybe the most early 2000s moment in the movie is when they decide to go see a band based on their MySpace page. This is why.
Yeah.
And then Adam Brody's the lead singer.
Yeah.
And Adam Brody, yeah, Adam Brody's MySpace page.
Yeah. But Jennifer, you know, she really wants to meet the guys in the band, and so she goes up and introduces herself to one of the guys in the band. And as soon as she goes to buy him a drink, Needy overhears them talking about her in like a weird way, like talking about her virginity or something like that. And so she marches right up and she's like, actually, my friend is a virgin, which you can sort of tell she's telling a lie when she says this, but she sort of defends her friend's honor, and they go and watch the concert. And the concert itself, like Emily mentioned, there's like all these dynamics happening. Needy is there beside Megan Fox, and they hold hands at you know, a moment. So we sort of like wonder, like, what is the sort of like extent of like their relationship? Like, Needy seems to need Jennifer more than Jennifer. Okay. I didn't write it.
It's in the script. I mean, it's there.
But, I mean, this then something very inexplicable happens, or maybe not inexplicable. I don't know. There's a fire, and this club burns to the fucking ground. It just burns, and, like, people die. Like, this is, like, you know, it's like the station fire, you know, where, like, 100 people died. It's very horrifying. And right after that, they go outside, like, you know, a few people escape, you know, Needy and Jennifer manage to escape. And immediately after that, the band comes over and they're like, hey, do you want to come in my van?
Yeah. Not creepy at all.
No.
That actually happened to me once. I was at a bar once.
You got in a van?
I was leaving. A bunch of guys. I was in Nashville, Tennessee. And me and my friend were leaving an incredibly sketchy bar. And a group of dudes were like, hey, you want to come with us in our van? And I was like, I have sobered up so fast now.
Oh, man.
I'm going, no, we're going back to the Holiday Inn. Goodbye.
So you didn't get in the van.
I haven't. Yeah, I did not get in the van with the scary men, which is
you're
why
still
I'm
here.
Not part of this movie. This is why
you're
I'm
not
still
a succubus or something.
That's good.
No, Jesus. Not as far as I know, anyways.
I would like to say, in defense of terrible bands, like, most bands have to have vans. Because when you're touring around, you need a van. It's not inherently creepy.
JM, like, did you ever invite someone into your band's van?
Well, I'm not done my story.
And I married her.
I do remember playing a show out of town, and a girl came up and asked to buy a CD, and they were only in the van. I said, you have to come out to the van.
Wait, and, did you say CD? Here's my van.
It was a CD van. And so I mean, I could tell as soon as I said, like, you know, we'll come out back to the van. You know, I could tell she, you know, was a little, you know, understandably. But, you know, I just sold her the CD and it was fine. But I'm just saying, like, there is this association with vans that they're, you know, full of creeps. And I'm saying, you know, sometimes you just need them to store equipment. These guys are bad, though. These guys are bad news.
I mean, they're. Yeah.
I do feel like I'd be more unsettled if I was meeting a band and they're like, "Do you want to come see our tour Honda Civic?" And I'd be like, "How are you getting around?"
Yeah. Where do you put the drums?
Jesus. My question was, like, is the fire an accident, or was it part of the band's plan, or what's happening there? Is it just like a coincidence?
I'm fairly sure it's part of the band's plan.
Yeah, because, like, Adam Brody's character seems pretty chill. He's just like, hey, what's up? He's, like, watching the fire. And then, I'm just going to keep playing my terrible indie music while this place burns to the ground.
It could have been more. I would have liked to see him, like, you know, putting, like, a flash pot or something, you know. I don't know. But Jennifer goes in the van with these creepy emo dudes, despite Needy telling her not to, and she decides to go. So Needy goes back home. She calls her boyfriend Chip, played by the guy who played young Neil in Scott Pilgrim, and
also J.K. Simmons' son.
Is that who that is?
Actually?
Yeah.
Oh,
what?
I was like, there's two Simmons in this movie. How funny!
No, I'm like 90% sure. I might be scaring us all. No, because he was also in the short of Whiplash,
right?
With J.K. Simmons. So I think he's his son. And then they lost him and put that jerk in his stead for the movie.
We're gonna need some confirmation of this. Can someone call Maury Povich or something?
Call Jerry Springer. J.K. Simmons gave me a real Jerry Springer vibe in this movie with the hair. It's so weird to see him with hair.
What,
like, he's one of those guys.
Claw hand? Why claw hand?
Well, some people have amputations and they use a claw. So
it was like his only character trait.
Yeah. Well, he also had some bad skin on his neck, I noticed. I was like, is that real or makeup? Get that checked out, J.K. And I'm not J.K. about that. Just kidding.
Well, that was because the cinematographer really hated J.K. Simmons and wanted to show all his neck wrinkles.
You know, I think I'm wrong on that, guys. I think I'm very, very wrong.
Okay, I will fact.
They just like putting his name... the two Simmons in movies together, apparently, for some reason.
Yeah, his name is Johnny Simmons. Yeah.
But are they not related? Does it not say who his parents are?
I looked up J.K. Simmons' son, and it said Joe Simmons, which is very close to Johnny.
But okay, a miss. Blaine. Look but what you miss. Started here. I started to hate the kid because, you know, I have that feeling whenever there are, like, children nepotism? Of celebrities who do actors and nepotism. Yeah. I've been watching The Boys and that Jack Quaid guy. Oh, he's a Quaid.
No, I liked Jimmy Simmons. I liked him in this movie.
He was good. Yeah, he has really that good. Bieber hair going on.
He is big, like my high school boyfriend energy in this movie.
Right. Yeah. I loved his bedroom. It was like every boy's bedroom in high school. He had like a unicycle in the background, and I was like, oh yeah. I wanted that. You know,
I was judging him so hard for that. I was like, this twerp.
Yeah.
But so. Needy goes back home, and she's calling her boyfriend, and then she hears something outside, and it's Jennifer, and she comes in, and she is not in a good state. She is all bloodied and freaking out, and she's also, like, acting weird. Like, first, she eats, like, a whole chicken out of the fridge, which we all get hungry, but, you know, use a fork. Though, I mean, you know, I'm not one to speak. Then she gets really weird, and she puts Needy up against the wall and gropes her and then starts asking if she's scared.
I would be too.
It's very it's very weird stuff. And then she goes off
after like vomiting up an oil drum onto the floor.
Right. And we don't see her until the sort of next day at school. And then of course with school everything is all messed up because of all the people dying. Like a whole bunch of people died and they're in mourning and everybody is coming together and people are sad and crying, including like there's this one kid who is like the football guy and he's sad and crying in the football field while some heavy death metal plays for some reason. And then he has to die.
Yeah, Megan Fox takes him to the woods and disembowels him. It's horrible.
Yeah. I mean, she makes like she's seducing him. So I mean, that seems good. But then, devours him.
What did you guys make of like all of the animals coming to watch?
Yeah.
Every time she started to seduce a man, every animal in the area would come and stare at them.
Animals love that.
I thought it made it cooler every time. Like, I was like, hell yeah, animal friends.
No, but I kind of thought that was kind of like this weird. Yeah, it was very weird. Maybe like a Snow White ish thing, like a perversion.
Snow White. When did that happen in Snow White?
She ate the prince's intestines.
No, right before she disemboweled Sleepy.
Yeah, see, they're backing me up, JM. Why can't you? Jesus, calling into question. No, the birds coming to help. Is that Cinderella? I don't know. It just seems like
it's like a fairy tale, like a fairy tale princess.
Like a fairy tale princess is what I'm trying to get.
Yeah.
Thanks, Rob. That's not what all, but that's better.
It is sort of strange. Yeah, you don't really see like animals going around demons like they are, you know, peaceful forest creatures usually.
She's like, "I'm Dr. Doolittle," and then she disembowels him.
I thought it was like a weird like forest creature pagan ritual kind of like communing with nature thing.
Mm.
But it also happens in the abandoned house with rats later on.
Oh yeah.
Not to skip ahead.
Mm.
No.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so
before you carry on, I do have an update on the J.K. Simmons, Johnny Simmons tale.
Debacle.
I mean, he was also in a movie called The Late Bloomer with J.K. Simmons.
Oh.
And in an article about that, it does say no relation between the two.
Wait, so this kid has been in three movies with J.K. Simmons and he's not his son?
Maybe it's like, remember how Arnold Schwarzenegger had that illegitimate son that looked exactly like Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he was just like hanging around? Maybe it's the same thing where he's like, I got this kid. He could really use a part. His name is also Simmons, but if we could keep it on the DL.
Hi, welcome to J.K. Simmons, the podcast, where it's all J.K. Simmons all the time.
I think he's worthy of a podcast. I think we should all just stop what we're doing and start that. in the closer? Come on. Come on.
He told Johnny Simmons that he was his father, and he's like, really? And he said, no, JK.
Oh.
Okay, I'm going to leave again. I'm going to go. I'm sorry.
But so everybody is really sad about this other guy who died. And a lot of these sort of displays of grief are a little bit like overblown and performative. And like they even have the band who was playing at the place that burned down. They keep playing their song as like this anthem that sort of brings everybody together. And it's really awful, but also very true to life, I think.
It gave me the feeling of like hearing the phrase how to save a life in like every single medical show in like the early 2010s. Like it was that vibe of a song.
These guys would have been on the soundtrack to Garden State. 100%.
Oh my God, they would.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, they say that they can't get on a soundtrack, and that's why they have to, you know,
murder
do the whole Robert Johnson, sell your soul to Satan or whatever.
Wait, Robert Johnson did not murder a virgin in the woods.
Well, I know. But I mean, like, it's the same result, right? Isn't it? Like, that's what they want. It's like they want to sell their soul. Or not. Maybe it's not the selling the soul, but it's still like some sort of pact with the devil for fame. It's a cliche. You know, mm-hmm. Not usually for emo bands, but, you know, they're always trying to act tough. So, you know,
Dashboard Confessional did that. That's why they got so big.
But I mean, Jennifer is not sad at all about the people dying. She seems pretty oblivious about all these people dying. And also she feels like really great. She feels like, I don't know, like she's Megan Fox or something, you know, just like owning the world. Though now that I've said it, I realize that is not correct. But, but I mean, you know, she feels young and vital and she has all this energy, but then the energy sort of starts to fade and she starts to look like, you know, a little bit haggard. And I guess you can see her hairs and...
Critics hate it.
She goes from a 10 to like a 9.8.
Yeah, it's disgusting, you know. As a male, I'm...
Thank God they don't put a pair of glasses on her. No,
can you imagine?
Yeah. And they're sort of getting ready for the school dance, but all these people keep dying. There's another kid who dies, the sort of goth kid. He asks out Megan Fox, and then, you know... She surprisingly says yes, you know, which is surprising because you can see this kid's underwear over his like jeans. It's you know, fashion was sad.
Kids those days.
Yeah. I'm old.
I mostly just kept looking at all like the chains and belts.
And, yeah.
I was like, I remember doing this in high school. I was like a gross punk kid in like the early 2000s. In small town Northern Ontario. Oh no.
I feel like
I feel this.
I feel like it's really interesting just to note that she was Jennifer was going to say no until Needy was like, he's actually a cool guy. And then she chose to change her answer and go out with him and then murder him.
Forget it.
That was random. I'm used to boys asking me out, Needy. Colin's really nice. He's into maggot rock. He wears nail polish.
My dick is bigger than his.
Well, I think he's really cool.
You do?
Yeah.
Wait, Colin.
I think it like sort of has to do with their dynamics of like the sort of jealousy, et cetera.
No, well, sure. Yeah, that's the thing I love about this movie is that, yeah, it's all kind of fed by these kind of sexual anxieties around like that central relationship. Because like the easy version of this movie would be if the Megan Fox character of Jennifer went after like the guys that did this to her. Like they still get their comeuppance in the end, not to jump ahead, but like, you know, that would be the simple version. But like you said, it's always, she's like punishing all the guys that like Needy has an attachment to,
mm-hmm.
like ultimately culminating in J.K. Simmons' song.
Heard it here first. We just got the results.
Yeah. All of her decision making around who she decides to feed from has to do with Needy.
Yeah,
and it's sort of, yeah, it's the kind of thing where I can never really totally tell if it's because she is sort of taking it out on Needy or if she is looking for that sort of like validation of like, this is someone who Needy approves of, which is like another way you could sort of like look at how she picks her victims in the movie.
I thought that it was more like she was jealous of Needy liking people other than her. So like, when it like came to the boyfriend, she was like, she was jealous of that relationship, not because she wanted the boy per se, but because it took Needy's attention away from her.
For sure.
I don't know. This is a conversation I had with a popular girl in high school. I wasn't very popular, and I talked to her, and she was like, "It's so hard."
Did you have glasses?
She didn't have glasses.
No, but no,
she
was like, you.
It's so hard being popular because you need to be more popular. Like her friends, they were all vying to be kind of the popular one, which I didn't know anything about. And it kind of when I was watching this movie, it kind of seemed like it's that deep need to continue that popularity and to get the support from Needy to be like, I am better than you, so I will take what's yours kind
right.
of thing. It's kind of what it felt like to me in this.
It's a power thing.
I love all these. There's so many different readings of this one central relationship. It's great. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
See, to me, no, I didn't see it like that personally, but I love that it's open to different interpretations too. I saw it more as like, she in this town, in this role she has in the school, like she isn't able to express her feelings towards Needy in the way she would want.
Mm.
So it kind of, the way it manifests is in these kind of like attacks to like get attention, like you were saying, like it's a way of inserting herself kind of into Needy's sexual life, but not in the way that she wants.
Yeah, or like trying to deny her bisexuality or feelings of attraction that she might have for Needy by killing men.
Yeah,
exactly.
What bi woman hasn't been there?
Yeah, which I feel like maybe, you know, in the wrong hands could be like a problematic story to tell. But there's something about like these two characters that you're invested in the whole time. Like Jennifer's not even really the villain until the very end, and even then it's like Needy's wants to avenge her. Like it feels like a real relationship, and the movie kind of builds everything else on top of that one relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, Needy is starting to sort of suspect that something is up, and so she goes to the occult section of the school library, and
there's an occult section.
Yeah, well, they got
just like the best line, one of the best.
They got a whole bunch of occult books from the Scholastic Book Fair when it came through. So, and luckily, it just happens that they got the ones that Needy needs, the one that tells you about the whole succubus thing. It's probably a very popular book, which is why these emo guys got it too. You know, it's definitely high school level magic with a K. But this also, it tells her what happens when the sacrifice happens, right?
It just tells her that she gets energy from, like, feeds off of men.
Right.
And the only way to kill her is when she's weak, and you have to go through the heart.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. Right. Yeah. The night of the big dance. So, like, this sort of scene where it's, like, not really clear what's happening. She's trying to say, like, it's not really safe for us to be together. And he's like, what, you breaking up with me? And she's like, we can't go to the dance together. And he's like, oh, what the fuck, man?
Yeah, that's a pretty realistic
reaction. Aggression than he actually has. I feel like he's big, soft high school boy energy.
He bought her an orchid. Yeah. It cost $12.
Yeah.
Can I just say that this
that
movie,
was my month's allowance.
I grew up in Sudbury, and this movie has big, sort of small, mid-sized town energy in a way that I don't see in a lot of other movies. And like, even when they were in the bar, it just reminded me of being like at the townhouse or at, there's a bar in Sudbury called the Beef and Bird. The logo is just the Boston Bruins B. And it's like the same kind of bar. And I was like, oh God. But yeah, the guy being like, I bought you an orchid. I was like, oh no, this is like, it's 2004 again. And I'm going to my boyfriend's semi-formal, like, Yeah. Oh, it feels real, man.
So she's told him not to go. She is going to go so that she can keep an eye on Jennifer, but he's not supposed to go. But she finds out that he's gone anyway, and she figures out that Jennifer is going to go after him to get to her. And so she runs to find him, and, you know, it's already sort of, like, almost too late because they're in this, like, you know, really creepy pool, and, yeah, and she's, like, biting his neck and not in the sexy way. And then Needy comes in, and she's ready to kick ass. This is like, you know, she like jumps right in. You know, she basically like gives like a flying suplex to Jennifer, and they manage to sort of escape. But he, you know, the boyfriend passes away. Poor Chip doesn't make it.
R.I.P. Chip.
Bieber hair as limp as the dead grass. Sad.
I found that death actually affecting.
I found it affecting too.
And it was only at that point that I stopped calling him Young Neil through the entire movie because I could never remember his name, and I just kept being like, Young Neil, no. But yeah, I think that was a well done death scene in this kind of movie where normally I would be like, okay, next.
Yeah. Yeah, they do manage to sort of impale Jennifer with a pool skimmer, but she survived, and she sort of goes back to her house. And this is sort of brings us back to a scene that we see earlier in the movie where when we still sort of think that Needy is the crazy one, where she is like going outside of Jennifer's window and peering really creepily. But at this point, she just fucking jumps through the window like, I don't know fucking what. It's like, it's amazing. And also, like, there would be lacerations. She would be in trouble. I mean, I heard a story about, you know, the woman who plays CJ Craig falling through a window. It does not sound nice, you know, for a person's
life. Allison Janney fell through a window?
Yeah, that's right.
Protect Allison Janney.
Who played the mom in Juno.
Yeah, there you go. She's actually Johnny Simmons' mom.
Oh wow.
Yeah, so it's come full circle.
Yeah, yeah. But this is where they have like their big epic confrontation. They sort of fight on Megan Fox's bed, and we forgot to talk about the big kiss thing, but I guess we'll have to circle back. But they fight and they wrestle.
That's it.
Been forever, huh?
You killed my fucking boyfriend, you goddamn monster, you dumb bitch!
You know what this is for? It's for cutting boxes. Do you buy all your murder weapons at Home Depot? God, you're butch.
And, you know, it seems like it's all going, like, badly, but until Needy sort of pulls off her best friend forever necklace. And that seems to be the fatal blow. It gets her in the heart. And then she stabs her with a box cutter.
You said that was such delight. The box cutter.
Well, they also, because they try to make like an innuendo too. They're like, what does this cut? And they're like, boxes? That's an innuendo, right?
Yeah, they meant it as an innuendo, for sure.
But then, like, they slashes him in the chest? I don't know.
Yeah, not the vagina.
And, yeah, and then her friend is dead. And, you know, just as her friend's mom comes in and sees her sort of kneeling over the body, and that sort of brings us full circle to sort of the beginning, to where she is in the mental institution, because, yeah, she's been obviously, you know, put there because she murdered her friend. But we find out that, you know, she got something in return when Jennifer bit her. She managed to get some of the secret demon powers. And so she, you know, sort of meditate, floats up and escapes. And then she gets revenge on Adam Brody and his douchey band.
I was waiting all
like,
movie.
Waiting for the rest of the movie.
Yeah, I know. I was waiting for so long. I was like, when is she going to kill him? They're the people. Go for them.
Just do it.
She was waiting for Lance Henriksen to roll into town in his sedan.
Yeah. Oh, my God.
I thought...
Oh, man, Lance Henriksen's so creepy in this, but very effectively so.
Jam was talking about this earlier, but I do think it was a really interesting choice to not have Jennifer go after Low Shoulder and to like save that for the very end, because I was also waiting for it. I was like, oh, I hate these guys so much. And you just hate them more and more. Like, they perform at the school dance. Like, they talk about how they saved everyone in the fire. Like, this is really an excellent performance for Adam Brody. I wanted to punch him in the face like every scene he was in.
Oh, he's just so greasy.
But yeah, it keeps it from being like a clear-cut revenge movie.
Yeah, yeah, I think so too. Yeah, it definitely does complicate things. Okay, we're going to take a short break. We have some behind the scenes and some trivia stuff when we return.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome back to Rewatchability. We're talking about Jennifer's Body with Emily and Alex from the Parkdale Haunts podcast. And I don't know if we told you this when you agreed to be on the podcast, but I do have some trivia questions for you.
Unprepared.
So, yeah, you
this
better...
This is not agreed to in my rider.
No.
Alex, surprise. I'm firing our agent.
Okay.
I am the agent. Or are you the agent?
I don't know. My cat's the agent.
You guys are going to have to figure that out. Okay, so first question. Diablo Cody has a lot of writing credits. What movie, which is sort of mentioned in this film, did she have a small part in?
Oh.
Or I should, more specifically, it's in the same franchise, I should say.
Did she...
I have no idea.
Did she write something for Halloween? Like the remake?
Yeah. I was about to say, I was like, what movies did they mention? I was like, I feel like they mentioned Halloween. They mentioned Evil Dead.
Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Yeah, and then...
Wait, what? What do you mean? God. She had a part in?
My final answer is The Shining.
Okay.
Wait. What do you mean, Rob? You mean she wrote it or she?
She participated. Oh. Not she acts, but she participated. You know.
Wait, in a movie that she wrote, or this is a different movie altogether?
No, she just is in the
it's
credits.
It's a movie
for.
That she's credited for writing, and it's sort of mentioned in this movie, or at least a movie in the same franchises.
Yeah, I don't know. What do you got? What is it?
Okay, so in the movie, just before the the very famous makeout scene, Needy says, "Are you wearing my Evil Dead T-shirt?"
It is
and-
Evil Dead.
Hey, I did. Yeah, let's say I said Evil Dead.
Everyone got it right.
But you didn't say.
But your final answer was The Shining.
You didn't say. You didn't say that you knew that she had something to do with Evil Dead, which she did. She did script revisions on the remake of Evil Dead that came out a few years ago.
You guys should have put it in the form of a question.
Oh, okay.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
True. Emily is right that I did decide that my final answer was The Shining.
Valid answer. I mean, it would have been good, but no. Okay, so, I mean, that one was a bit windy, twisty, turny, but I sort of found it interesting. And, you know, she probably got that job, presumably, because of Jennifer's Body, despite, you know, the reputation that it had when it came out. So, you know, people out there are definitely recognizing her sort of horror credibility, which I thought was great.
I actually really liked the remake. I know that it was controversial, but I'm a fan.
Yeah, there you go. Another Diablo Cody masterpiece.
Is she credited as the? I never saw the remake. I wanted to.
She's not credited, okay. But she did
do rewrites,
do script revisions. Mm. Yeah, she's. It says she's uncredited on the IMDb, so that's her credit. Okay, so we've talked a lot about Johnny Simmons' dad, J.K.
By the way, J.K. Simmons' wife is a big listener to this podcast, and she is packing her bags as we speak.
I have already changed his Wikipedia page.
But how many Diablo Cody films feature J.K. Simmons?
Oh, no.
Three? I'm going to say four.
Oh, okay.
Four.
Okay. Jim, do you have an
I'm
answer?
I'm going to say 5 just to be different.
Okay, Price is Right rules, right?
Wait, no, that's the opposite of what I should say then. I'll say 1.
Okay. It's Damn 3. It. Yeah, Alex, I think you got that one. Blaine, I think you got that wrong. Oh, and it is wrong. Judo. Jennifer's body, of course, and he does have a voice in young adult. He sort of comes around whenever Jason Reitman comes around. So he's in basically all of Jason Reitman's movies. And since Jason Reitman produces so many of Diablo Cody's movies, here he is. And he's great in this. I thought it was a really interesting turn for him, especially since he was playing like, you know, tough guys like J. Jonah Jameson and Mr. Whiplash. And then he was playing like this sort of like ineffectual teacher. I thought it was good.
Oh my God. I liked it. I can't remember for sure, but was the teacher's name Mr. Whiplash in that movie? Because that would be fantastic.
I can't wait for the hook to come back.
Yeah, I also did like sort of wonder, like, did the hook happen during one of the calamities that we saw previously? Was he at the rock show and like maybe a beam fell on his hand? I don't know.
I like to imagine that he just showed up one day on set and he's like, I've decided my character has a hook for a hand.
We haven't really talked about how eclectic this cast is, because there's J.K. Simmons, there's Amy Sedaris, his mom. There's Chris Pratt as himself.
Oh, pretty much.
Can we quickly talk about the line in the movie where she's like, Jennifer's like, I have the police department wrapped around my little finger. I am having sex with a cadet. So
yeah, that's funny.
I think that's one of the best lines in the movie.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, there are a lot of great cameos and, you know, great casting in this movie. I mean, it does really seem to, because it's sort of a comedy, it sort of has a different sort of leeway than a traditional horror movie would. Like, I don't think you would cast J.K. Simmons the same way or Amy Sedaris if it was like a straight horror film. Though, maybe, that could be
and
interesting.
And who was the kid with the goth kid? He was on Veronica Mars, right? With Amanda Seyfried?
Yeah, he played Beaver.
Yeah, Beaver.
Right, Beaver.
I knew it was you all along.
Oh,
man. Spoilers.
Okay.
I had the worst recognition of him, where I was sitting there and I was like, where do I know him? And I was like, he was on CSI New York. And that's where I recognized him from. And I feel permanently embarrassed that was my callback for him.
That is the worst CSI.
he played Gary Sinise's character's dead wife's secret son.
Oh my God, a real wow. Johnny Sims. That's crazy.
Real layers.
Okay, I have one more trivia question for you guys. So this is a big one. The title of this movie comes from a song by a band who has a different song in this movie. What is the band?
Low Shoulder.
That's correct.
Oh, Motion City Soundtrack?
No.
It's a good guess.
I've run out of bands.
Wait, what'd you say?
What?
It's Hole. It's definitely Hole.
It's Hole.
Yeah, it's Hole. Yeah, it's Hole. Yeah, it's based off the Hole song, classic Hole song, Jennifer's Body, which is not in this movie, but they do have another one there. You can hear Courtney Love's trademark yowl as the credits roll. Oh, we should also mention, like, there's a terrible cover in this movie of I Can See Clearly Now the Rain Is Gone, which is relevant because Johnny Nash, the writer of that song, died just the other day. And they say that every man dies twice, but I think Johnny Nash died 3 times. Like, once when his song was covered by that crappy punk band.
No, what punk band did that?
How dare you besmirch the good name of Pop Goes Punk.
I love those CDs.
The album compilations that got us all through 2005. Okay.
You know what? Those covers introduced all those songs to a new generation. I'm sure that in the end, more good was done than harm. That's all my trivia questions. You guys did pretty well. Pretty well. This movie, when it sort of came together, I mean, it was sort of like riding on the Diablo Cody name, because she had sort of made such a huge splash with Juno. And she won the Oscar, right? For her screenplay.
I think so, yeah.
I should know that. So it was like a huge, there's a lot of expectation for it when it came out. That's the thing that I remember most, was just like people were sort of like waiting for her to follow up this thing that has like presented this sort of distinct and new voice. So there was already a lot of hype for it, I remember. And as we sort of talked about, it did not do well at the time. It cost it cost $60 million to make, and then domestically it only pulled in $60,204,000.
Oh no.
So it only made 200,000 more than it cost, which I mean that sounds like a profit, but I don't, apparently that's not enough in Hollywood.
Well, it's also standard, it doesn't take into the marketing.
No.
Which they blasted that movie everywhere, so that must have cost millions of dollars as well. So they probably
absolutely.
One thing about the writing that I was thinking about when I was watching this, because I remember I'd watched Juno years ago and I was like, okay, like she has a very, very distinct style with her writing. And I remember that I feel like there was so much backlash when this movie came out, not just towards Megan Fox for existing, but also I think just to Diablo Cody for, I think just
existing.
Daring to have a very distinct style in her writing that like, and I mean, like, there are lots of writers and directors and everyone who have incredibly distinct styles, but I do think that there is just this real inherent toxicity around the discussion around her and also Megan Fox of just like, ugh, she made a second movie? God, don't we all know, how dare she make another thing that, you know, clearly proved to be successful before, let us all shun her now. For this thing, and watching it, I was like, there are definitely things that did not hold up in the writing, but overall, I was like, it's snappy, it's distinct. There's some like legitimately funny stuff in here,
and I felt like she even kind of like stepped back from like doing her dialogue like bullet fast and so quirky. Like she did kind of step back, and I thought it was very, very funny. I didn't think. Going into this, I thought this wasn't a horror comedy, and so I was delighted to find out it was. And I thought it was so much more comedy than horror. And if it had been maybe marketed that way as a comedy, then it might have worked. I don't know. Maybe more people would have seen it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think some of the backlash in the reviewing is that people just didn't know what to make of the genre. They didn't know whether it was a black comedy or a horror, and therefore just kind of concluded that it failed at both. But I don't know. I think it succeeded at both, in my opinion.
I also think there's something about, you know, we were talking about how Megan Fox has kind of been like being reevaluated now because we're learning more about how her, you know, her career was kind of torpedoed because she spoke up about, you know, the way she'd been treated and Michael Bay and all that. But there's something about her performance that is so kind of low-key amazing in this movie, in the way that she's able to take some of the more like quippy, bantery Diablo Cody, you know, witticisms and make them sound like that character would be actually saying them. You know what I mean? Like she has a lot of really funny lines that could sound so forced coming out of another actress. I don't know. I'm not a Megan Fox fan by any stretch. I can't even think of another Megan Fox movie I've seen other than
Transformers.
Transformers, which I don't like. But there's watching it, especially now watching it like a third time, I really kind of locked into an appreciation of how she makes those jokes work and makes it like it never kind of perforates the reality of the movie to make it seem like this kind of, you know, written bantery thing. I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense, but I just really appreciated it.
I thought they did a really good job too, or specifically Megan Fox in her performance of, she's obviously gorgeous. She knows that she's gorgeous, but she still has this fundamental insecurity that you can see peeking through like various times. Like I definitely think about that scene where she's just sitting, looking at herself in the mirror, just smearing makeup all over her face. Mm-hmm. Or when she's talking about like how like she has bad skin, she's like the regular girls now. She's a character who is possessed by a demon, but she still manages to have moments of vulnerability, which I think is not an easy thing to achieve.
Yeah, for sure.
Totally.
For sure. Yeah.
There's if you ever want a great thing on Megan Fox, there's a YouTuber named Lindsay Ellis, and she did a series on explaining film theory using only the Transformers movies.
Oh, wow.
and it's fascinating. And she did one that just looks at Megan Fox and looking at like gays and stuff like that. And she also points out that in the Transformers movies, Michaela is the only character with an arc. She's the only one who grows and changes and like has any sort of interesting personality qualities.
Cool.
So, yes, highly recommend Lindsay Ellis's theories or film theory studies thing entirely. It's called the Whole Plate, and it's only film theory through the lens of the Transformers.
Cool. That does sound amazing. So I wanted to talk about a little bit about the critical reevaluation of this movie, because there's been a heck of a lot of articles. A lot of the articles are just sort of surprised that it's been critically reevaluated. So it's like a Russian stacking doll of like, you know, critical reevaluation. Hey, people have said this movie's good. Hey, people have said this movie's good. But I mean, there are some things about this movie that those sort of critical evaluations didn't seem to deal with or seem to like glaze over. Like, for example, like this movie is, you know, it's been re-embraced by like an LGBT crowd, but at the same time, it's a movie where there's a lot of like casual homophobic slurs sort of like tossed around by the main characters, by other characters. And, you know, I sort of wondered, like, is this a movie that sort of undoes itself with that? Or like, what's happening when these characters are, you know, using that language, but also like this is, you know, contended to be like a queer positive film?
Well, it seems to me from what we've been talking about and the relationship at the center that's kind of where the positivity is coming from, and that relationship is having to contend with the state and the culture in which it is in and which the story takes place, right? So I could see that it's like it could be embraced by someone being like, well, this is clearly like a queer story, and then at the same time be like eschewed by someone being like, well, there's a lot of homophobia in it too.
Yeah,
so it does kind of play both sides.
Yeah.
So I would say that first of all, like, there's not a lot of queer representation in horror. Just full stop. So I understand why people would sort of look at this and be like, at least there is representation. I think another thing is when there is queer representation, often it's the person is coded evil because they're queer.
Right.
So if we look at like, I don't know, like a Norman Bates character,
right?
Like he's sort of coded as being homosexual, gay, kind of in his mannerisms, etc. But like, he's also crazy. He's insane.
Mm-hmm.
For Jennifer's character, it's more so that she's been made evil by men and by pursuing men. And her sort of bisexuality is not the thing that made her crazy or evil. It was actually a mediocre indie band that made her that way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I wondered about that as well, because, I mean, older horror movies, in like the way that we would sort of look at them, the queerness is sort of, like you said, sort of equated with monstrosity. And sort of in this movie, one way that you could read it is that Jennifer doesn't exhibit any sort of like queerness or anything like that until after she becomes a monster. And that's where it starts to sort of ramp up. And like at the beginning, like she's a person who is, you know, very like confident in her sexuality and who like uses her sexuality as a powerful thing. And so that sort of continues on, but like the queer aspect really only seems to pop into her character like once she sort of turns into this other thing, though it may be like sort of latently in the relationship between Needy, probably particularly with Needy and Jennifer, or like, you know, it's also part of like, you know, maybe the tension of platonic female friendships. But I don't know, like, what do you guys think about that? Like, do you think that holds any water?
Well, I think also the two love scenes I think are really key in this movie, because you guys were talking about how the movie's not very scary. I would argue that the scariest scene is the heterosexual sex scene between young Neil and Amanda Seyfried, because like it's awkward and uncomfortable, and then she literally starts seeing like corpses, yeah. You know, ghosts in the room, and then that's like immediately followed up by the scene between Jennifer and Needy where they kiss, and it's very tender and it's very sensitively filmed and sexual and even romantic. And so I think like the contrast between those is does like, it doesn't even just like tell me that, it makes me feel that like these characters are expressing something that's more true to them than what they've been living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that if I wanted to sort of put sort of like a positive, I guess like my own sort of positive read on it. Cause yeah, I mean like she obviously sort of knows that she's beautiful and knows that she can sort of use her looks to her advantage like that. And, but I also think it speaks to like, you know, when you're young and you're a teenager, especially if you're a teenage girl, you have so little power, you have so little ability to sort of do anything. And, you know, sometimes you just kind of want to wield whatever you can in the only way that you know how to, I guess. And I guess for her, and like living in this tiny town, like, you know, she's using it because she wants to go hang out with a band. Like, it's not like she's, you know, out there using it for evil or something. She wants to go hang out with a band. Like, I too was a teenager. I also wanted to hang out with bands. But I think when you were mentioning about how sort of her bisexuality sort of comes up more to like after she's turned, I would sort of say that like she becomes she's a succubus at this point, but she also has power now and she knows it. And I think that she's less afraid to use it and less afraid to be herself and less afraid to sort of make those moves in a way that like previously, when you know that you're constantly sort of walking this tightrope of like being shunned or being turned away or like losing what little you have. Now she's like, well, I can jump out a window if I want to, if this, like, you know, if this goes wrong. So like, whatever, man. Right.
Interesting.
So just going back sort of to how I was talking about how their relationship reminded me of relationships that I had in high school. I think it's a part of it that I saw myself in is that their intimacy is so intense and so confusing that you can kind of read yourself into it as questioning your own queerness, especially in terms of like those kinds of relationships where it's like when you were a kid, you shared a bed. Now that you're a teenager, you're still sharing a bed and you're still cuddling and maybe you're touching each other. But does that mean that you're queer? Does that mean that you want to be together? Or does that just mean that you're very close? And it's kind of that negotiation that you see between them and feels very, very real to me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's also interesting that they're like so close, I guess, because she got bit too, but so close that they can almost feel what each other feels. So like it's becoming a very like...
That's even before that. They already seem supernatural
at
the beginning.
Like there's a supernatural intimacy there to begin with that confuses all the issues. So
I almost wonder what the movie would be if it didn't have this supernatural aspect, because it already seems like it's going somewhere dark from the beginning with their friendship, because it's not like they're friends, but it's like a toxic friendship. There's like a lot of like weird power stuff going on between Jennifer and, you know, and Needy is just needy, you know, so she puts up with everything and she doesn't seem to be able to recognize when her friend is abusing her or bullying her. But, you know, I think that's a really interesting thing to play in a horror movie and a interesting relationship to explore.
But it also feels like Jennifer needs Needy as well. Like as much as she is like going off with a band in a van or whatever, like those are the moments where she feels, where she seems and sees most vulnerable when she's not with Needy. So it feels like they can't almost be together, but they can't be apart either. And I just think it's a really wonderful relationship at the center of this movie and really carried the whole movie for me.
Yeah, it's absolutely a toxic relationship, but it's still so intensely intimate and real. Yeah.
Yeah.
And some relationships are toxic, you know, and some friendships are toxic, Blaine.
Okay, Rob, geez.
Okay, so we should wrap it up. Let's go around and say what we thought about it this time around. Emily, let's start with you. What did you think on your most recent rewatch of Jennifer's Body?
On my most recent rewatch of Jennifer's Body, I think this time I was a lot more... I'd kind of gotten over the flashy succubus killing men aspect of it, so I was able to see kind of more of the details. And this time when I watched it, I was like, this is just a really great high school movie. This is a very real, hilarious high school movie. It was very spot on for me. As I said, I graduated high school in 2008. So everything from the aesthetics of wearing like a denim miniskirt with like a puffer jacket, I was like, oh yeah, I remember that. And it just, it's probably weirdly the closest to my high school experience I've seen on film besides Mean Girls.
Wow.
So that's what stuck with me this viewing.
Cool.
Wow. It seems like you had a bad high school experience.
It wasn't great. No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Fuck high school.
Okay, Alex,
whatever.
What about you?
Yeah, I had never seen it before, and I'm in a weird way, like, I feel like I both am kind of glad that I hadn't seen it before, because I know that 2009 me would have been much harder on this movie, and much more critical, but I also think that I kind of wish I had seen it back then, because, yeah, like Emily said, there is a lot of things that kind of remind me of my own high school experience. And I think it was just really fun, and I really enjoyed it, I think, more than I thought I would. And I'm glad to have watched it.
Yeah, I'm with you, Alex. Like, I really enjoyed watching this. I enjoyed the Screeching Weasel cover of but I enjoyed hearing all those old punk bands and the story. It was a surprising story. I thought it was just going to be a pretty simple revenge story, and it turned into something really more complex and something that we've talked like an hour and 15 minutes about, because that central relationship is so complex and is so...
We do that for every movie.
Story.
We did that for Coneheads. That's not a bar of excellence.
We had to reach for Coneheads. We didn't have to reach for this one. It's way more of a complex movie than I thought it was, and I'm glad I watched it, and I will watch it again in a couple years' time on Halloween for sure. What about you, JM?
I really, really like this movie. Like I said, I watched it for work like a few months ago. It was during the pandemic. I don't know. It all blurs together, but not that long ago. So I was kind of like, it's been long enough that I should probably watch it again for the podcast, but it's so recent that I didn't feel like watching it. And once I was watching it, it is just such an entertaining movie. Like even before we start unpacking all this, like, it's just funny and it just moves well. And I love that tone where it is genuinely humorous, but then also like not only the horror stuff, which actually has some, you know, grisly images, but even just like the stakes being so real. Like, there are some deaths of great import that aren't glossed over or don't feel, superficial. So I just think it's a really great movie. I will definitely watch it again.
Okay. I think I must be the odd person out because I didn't love the movie. And, you know, I watched it. I read the critical reassessments. I rewatched it. And something about it just doesn't hit for me. I think that it sometimes doesn't find the right place in the tone. Like, there are a bunch of things that I know are supposed to be funny, but just don't feel funny to me. Like, when the dad finds out that his son is dying and he's like, "She ate off his face like a door knocker," or something like that. And it just, I don't know. It didn't do it for me. And it felt like really sort of tonally sort of everywhere. Like, I know that.
Really?
Yeah, I know that Diablo Cody is like critiquing things, and there's a lot that like I think is really interesting to think about in there. But I had to do a lot of reading to enjoy it, so I don't know whether or not that makes it a good film for me. But I think there's definitely a lot in it. I love that it explores like a really interesting relationship. I think all of the performances are really good. Amanda Seyfried and Megan Fox are both great. And poor young Neil, he was also just, yeah. But I don't know if I'll watch it again. I don't know. It just didn't really do it for me. But I consider it sort of like all my favorite artists are like artists who sort of make ambitious movies and don't quite make it all the time. For this one, for me, this movie doesn't quite, you know, do what I think the artists were trying to do, but I still think it's a really interesting film. And that's rewatchable.
Oh, man.
You guys can
I just want to say before.
All right. This is just like the debate, okay? Don't interrupt me.
One thing I wanted to say really quickly is that there is kind of this reemergence of looking at it as a feminist film. I worry that does put too much pressure on this movie.
Yeah.
Because at the end of the day, it is just a campy, fun horror movie. And there's a lot that's interesting about it. There's a lot that you can read into it, unpack from it. But at the end of the day, it's just campy.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
I want to say this is I just wanted to point out something that I read that I forgot to mention earlier, which is when they were talking about the marketing. It's not just that we found it bad. Also, Diablo Cody and Karen Kusama were really upset about it. And I mean, this is kind of funny. Well, this part's not funny, but one of the ideas the studio had to promote the movie was to host an amateur porn site to promote the movie.
Oh, my God.
I don't know how that ties into this movie at all. And then when they got the poster for the movie and the tagline was, "She's got a taste for bad boys," it said Karen Kusama and Diablo Cody emailed the studio asking them to kind of explain themselves. And Diablo Cody said the email they got back wasn't even grammatically correct. It just said, "Jennifer sexy, she steal your boyfriend."
Oh my.
As if a caveman had written it.
I don't think we should impugn the caveman.
The marketing was done by like a copy paste or whatever. It's awful.
Oh my God. There's like, I feel like, that just broke my brain.
I mean, it does seem really bad, but I also think, and you know, I don't want to like, this movie does play with Megan Fox being a particularly attractive person. And it's like, in a way, like subverting a lot of the things that she was sort of like forced to do. So it's like, it's not surprising that like the marketing focuses on her being attractive. But I think like it should have been like subversive. I can see wanting to draw in using that thing because that is like kind of what the movie does in a way. But yeah, not like that. It's unfortunate.
Well, yeah, I think the thing is that like it's not. Like she is beautiful. She's gorgeous.
And that's a choice
beautiful
that
in the movie.
They made.
That is a big part of it. And it's perfectly fine for her to be beautiful. I think the main problem is that they marketed this movie to like 17 to 32 year old men being like, "Hey, you want to go watch some sexy ladies?" And I'm like, you should have just marketed it to women.
Yeah.
That would have made a huge difference.
And then
they just played up the fact that they're like, "Sexy ladies, here we go."
And then the only real sex scene we actually get is that incredibly awkward one.
I thought that was a kind of sweet.
Needy and her boyfriend.
I thought it was sweet too,
but it's not like, I thought it's very sweet, but it's not like, you know.
No, I know.
That's not,
I mean,
that didn't turn me on.
No, I mean.
Yeah, it's not tiddly.
But it was very like, you know, yeah, that's just what sex felt like. I mean, that's at least what sex felt like for me in high school. Is a very like, you know, we're having sex now.
We're having fun, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of like awkward smiles and like, boy, this is good, right?
Yeah, I mean, I like that because it was a very realistic. But you know,
at least he was checking
this movie does so much. It's a very rich film, I would say. You know, no matter where you sort of come down, there's definitely a lot to sort of dig into, as we've proved, you know, in this hour. So, Emily and Alex, where can people find your podcast?
Yeah, it's Parkdale Haunt. We're on the Frequency Podcast Network, wherever fine podcasts are found. And be sure to check it out, especially if you like complicated relationships between women, which is sort of the main focus of this
podcast. I hope they're not as complicated as this movie's relationships between women.
I mean, there's close.
Okay.
There's
all right. All right.
Yeah. Well, I can't wait to check it out. Thanks so much for being on.
Yeah. Thanks so much. And yeah, we're on social media too.
Thanks for Parkdale Haunt.
Cool. And we're Rewatchability. You can find us on Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or Spotify. And we're on the social media as well on Facebook/Rewatchability. You can @Rewatchability us on Twitter. Go to Patreon if you want to become a Patreon and get those bonus episodes. And also go to Apple Podcasts and rate and review us. And I think that's all of the stuff. So until...
Those are all the things you can do on the internet.
Yeah. That's all of them.
Or go to Jennifer's body amateur porn site. Is that what it was? Jesus Christ!
No.
Yeah, whose idea was that?
Don't do it.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.